TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Naomi Klein, This Changes Everything. The Santa Rosa Veterans Auditorium is a huge cavernous building in a small town in Northern California. Nobody really knew until the evening of the event if a grassroots coalition of labor, immigrant rights, faith-based union, and environmental organizations would be able to fill it. When the internationally acclaimed Canadian writer Naomi Klein arrived with her 2-year-old son in arm, they looked through the stage door at a crowd of almost 1,000. Naomi Klein's most recent book, This Changes Everything, connects capitalism and climate change. It describes the current most pressing economic problems as they tie in with the dramatic unraveling of the climate system. And instead of sowing despair, her analysis and advice empower to work on a solution to both capitalism and climate change. In part one of this program, you heard Naomi Klein's talk. Here now is a full half hour of questions and answers. The first question was, is there any point in working with corporations which recognize that climate change is a problem? Naomi Klein.
I think it depends on the nature of the recognition and the nature of the partnership. There's no doubt that there are corporations that are a big part of what we need to do to get off fossil fuels. You know, here in California, you have a company like Sungevity, which is, you know, a really, really interesting solar company that has made solar power affordable to a great many people. So, you know, when I say that capitalism is in conflict with what we need to do to respond to climate change, I'm talking about a system. I'm talking about an ideology, and I'm also talking about the conflict between a system that is built on the pursuit of short-term growth and the fact that we need to get our emissions down as quickly as we need to, and indeed we need to get to zero in emissions. So what I'm saying is that the market can't get us there. We cannot leave this to the market, but will private players be part of a transition? Yes, they will. I think that they will have to be a much smaller part of our economy than they currently are. We're going to have much larger parts of our economy that are in the public sector, that are working on a nonprofit basis, that are cooperatively owned. But I don't think this is saying that there are, you know, no corporations that can be part of the solution. We can point to examples of that, but we also can't mistake a thriving market in renewable energy and green tech for a solution to climate change, because capitalism is extremely adaptable. You can simultaneously have a booming green tech market, a booming fossil fuel market, and a booming disaster capitalism market to clean up from the wreckage. It can do all things simultaneously. So if we're going to take the science seriously and we're going to take our emission targets seriously, we simply cannot leave it to the market to do this for us. It can't pull it off. In terms of partnerships and green groups, I think this has been a big problem. And personally, I don't think that environmental groups should be making partnerships with corporations. I think they need to be maintaining their independence.
The next question. If the Republicans take over the U.S. Senate, how do we stop the Keystone XL pipeline and fracking?
Like I said, I mean, I don't believe we're going to do this without some really serious political change, structural change in terms of the influence of money in politics, in terms of corporate personhood. I mean, I think we need to actually be getting at the sickness at the heart of the American political system. But I don't think it means, just because the Republicans have even more power than they have right now, that we're going to lose every battle. The battles that are being won in the book, I call it blockadia, which is a term that comes from the anti-Keystone XL movement. You know, they're being won in red states and blue states, and they're being won because of incredible grassroots organizing. I live in Canada where we have a very right-wing government that has entirely merged with the fossil fuel lobby. Its single idea and purpose is to advance the Alberta tar sands and just ravage and flay our country as quickly as they possibly can. But they're having a hell of a time building pipelines. They're having a hell of a time because of a very powerful Indigenous rights movement that is fighting them in the courts, that is fighting them, you know, on every level, and you know, because of regional power and so on. So I don't think that just because the Republicans get more power, that means we throw in the towel.
Another question. What do you think of Ellen Brown and the public banking solution? Can locally owned public banks help our situation?
Yeah, no, this is really interesting, and I think that it is a huge part of the solution. And anything that diversifies our economy away from this that short-term profit motive is part of the solution. And this is another piece of the divestment movement that I'm excited about is the investment movement. The idea of not just moving money away from fossil fuel companies, but investing it in the kinds of institutions that we need, institutions of the next economy. So I don't just mean like big, you know, solar companies and wind companies, but also the public institutions, the locally owned institutions, the municipal bonds, rebuilding the public sphere. Yeah, it's a big piece of it. And anything that brings resources to communities and allows them to act in the public interest and gets past that idea that we can't do anything because we're broke is obviously a huge part of the solution.
Next, a very specialized question. Cloud seeding for rain worked so well since the 1940s. Why is it discontinued in California?
I don't think that's necessarily true, that the record of cloud seeding is anything like that successful. That's not what I've found in my research. Like, I don't know the situation here in California with cloud seeding. It's not a debate I'm following. I have a lot in my book about geoengineering and the idea of interfering with the climate system at a global scale, and frankly, it's absolutely terrifying stuff. And, you know, I worry about, frankly, anything that brings us closer to normalizing geoengineering, because there are a lot of people who think that it is more serious to talk about dimming the sun than putting up solar panels, precisely because it isn't a challenge to our economic system.
Here's the next question. Is it your opinion that people see democracy and capitalism as the same thing? And is that part of the problem to get change started?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're still really oddly in this Cold War time warp, where I guess people's biggest discomfort with me naming capitalism is that they think that the only thing other than capitalism is centralized state socialism. I guess that's part of it. I mean, the idea that you have like capitalism and democracy on one side and socialism and authoritarianism on the other side, as if these are only options available. And obviously, you know, we know that authoritarian state socialism was just as bad for the environment as capitalism. In the book, I talk about this, you know, at length. In the book, I talk about how, if we're going to confront climate change, it really does mean the end of that far-right worldview. It's not about making, you know, building bridges with Republicans and trying to convince them this isn't a threat. It's simply not true. They understand this better than a lot of liberals. If the whole move of the Republican Party towards climate change denial is a reflection of the fact that they understand that if we are going to deal with this crisis, we have to intervene in the market in ways that are ideologically abhorrent to them, so they choose to deny the science. In terms of capitalism and democracy, I actually think that most people, normal people, no longer equate capitalism and democracy and have big questions about capitalism, associated with rampant greed. And then, you know, what do we have to say about China? I mean, China is, you know, arguably the most successful capitalist economy in the world, and it's successful largely because it's not a democracy. Democracy is not getting in the way. And it's able to ruthlessly pursue these types of policies without having to consult anybody and just able to trample on rights at will.
And a follow-up question for Naomi Klein. What would an alternate economic system look like, and what would we call it?
The question of what to call it is a tricky one. But in terms of what, you know, and I'm not Lenin, you know, the book is not sort of like, it's not a 10-point plan of how to, you know, build the next economy. But I do think that we know what the principles of the next, you know, we've got some really good principles for what that next economy should be. And at the core of it, I think, is that obviously we need an economic model that takes as its guiding mission the protection and regeneration of life on Earth. That seems to me to be a good starting point. And this is why, I know what I was saying about the right, is that, okay, it's obviously cataclysmic for the right to acknowledge this reality, but it's challenging to large parts of the left as well. You know, I mean, if we look at the left-wing governments in Latin America, many of which are doing fantastic things when it comes to poverty eradication, they're still based on, most of them, on an extractivist logic, on an extractivist economic model. So we do need to move to something else. But there are really interesting debates. I think the most interesting and sophisticated debates on this are happening in Latin America, in these tensions in countries like Ecuador and Bolivia, where you have huge indigenous rights movements that are increasingly in conflict with left-wing extractivist governments, and that are articulating principles like rights of nature, vivir, like the principle that, you know, we all can live well, but we can't keep living better and better. So I think that these principles are being articulated, and in terms of what we call it, you know, there's a bit of a branding problem all around. And, you know, I would be happy to have, you know, a new name. But I think at the core, it is a regenerative economy, and regeneration has to be the guiding principle of this economy, more than sustainability or resilience or any of those words.
The next question. Do you have faith in Obama to deny the Keystone XL pipeline?
No, I have no faith. I mean, I'm frankly shocked he's held out as long as he has, and he clearly wants to punt this decision. I mean, I think, you know, when we first came up with the sort of the national Keystone campaign at 350, there was already local campaigns, you know, in all of the states that the pipeline was crossing through. But the idea of developing a real national strategy around Keystone and the civil disobedience and all of that, that was based on the idea that Obama had to make a decision 3 years ago, right? And he's been delaying and delaying and delaying. It's incredibly hard, clearly, for him to say no. But, you know, from a tar sands perspective, from a Canadian perspective, so it's all good, right? Any delay is a victory, because what this movement is already achieving is it's spreading investor uncertainty in the tar sands, and we're already starting to see some big projects like Statoil, the Norwegian oil company that's very active in the tar sands, just announced that it was putting a major tar sands expansion project on hold, and it cited one of the reasons was uncertainty about pipeline capacity, meaning Alberta's landlocked, and they're not sure if they dig this stuff up, they can get it out, right? And that's because of all these various blockadia-style resistance movements against every pipeline they want to build, not just Keystone, but there's like four of them proposed in Canada. We're hitting them from every angle. Tom Goldtooth, who's founder of IEN, the Indigenous Environmental Network, he said to me many years ago, he said, look, these are the arteries. We need to cause a heart attack. It's starting to happen, you know? So they are having a heart attack in the Alberta Star Sense. I have to go there in a few days. I'm terrified. Speaking in Calgary, wish me luck.
And a question on saving energy. When replacing fossil fuels comes up, nobody talks about energy efficiency. We need only half the power for the same output.
That's a good point. And we need to be talking about the demand side, not just the supply side. And that is efficiency, but that's also redesigning our cities so that we think about mobility differently. It's about really reinventing mobility. And that is a project of urban design, and it's really exciting. I mean, this is where you see the ways in which responding to climate change so concretely improve quality of life, when people are able to spend less time in their cars commuting, when they're able to walk to their basic services, when they're able to ride their bikes. I mean, people are happier, they're healthier. It's so tangible. I feel like this is such an obvious point in California, but I'll say it anyway. Nuclear, the truth is we don't need nuclear. I mean, the research, the really cutting-edge research out of Stanford University, coming from Mark Jacobson and his team, that says that we can get to 100% renewable energy for all of our energy needs, including transportation, by 2030. And I interviewed Mark Jacobson for the book. I said, okay, does this mean that do we need natural gas from fracking? And he said, and this is important, so not only don't we need nuclear, but we don't need unconventionals. That's what he said. He said, yes, you need to burn fossil fuels to get off fossil fuels. That's true, right? As we're rolling out this energy transition, we're going to burn a lot of fossil fuels because our economy is based on fossil fuels. But we can do this with conventional oil and gas. We don't need to move into tar sands, and we don't need to be moving into fracking. This idea that it's a bridge fuel is a lie. What it is easier politically to switch from coal to gas because it's the same corporatist model. It doesn't require confronting those wealthy interests. And same thing with nuclear. Nuclear is seen as more politically feasible because it doesn't challenge the economic model, whereas decentralized renewable energy is a challenge. I mean, the thing about fossil fuel, an economy based on fossil fuels, but really on any kind of heavy extraction, and I would include nuclear in this, definitely, right, is that it lends itself to wealth concentration, right? Because the fossil fuels are in specific places, it takes a lot of money to get them out, it takes a lot of money to refine them, it takes a lot of money to transport them. In the case of nuclear, it takes a hell of a lot of money to deal with the waste, it certainly takes a hell of a lot of money to clean up afterwards. Whereas with renewables, they're free, right? I mean, the core product, at least, is everywhere. The wind is everywhere. The sun is everywhere. The source is free. And it's just a much lighter technology. It doesn't cost as much. There are profits to be made from renewables, but not the kind of stupid profits that you're going to get from these centralized corporatist models of fossil fuels and nuclear. So that's why I think it's easy for people who are trying to figure out a way to change in a way that doesn't challenge our current economic order to imagine flipping a switch from fossil fuels to nuclear. I think many of the people making that argument see the idea of this broader transformation as basically unthinkable.
The answer to the next question that Naomi Klein gives under her breath is iPhones. The person asked, what is it about capitalism that wants us to keep any of the system in place?
iPhones, I think. I don't know what is about capitalism. I think the genius of the system, and I don't even think it's planned, is that it is brilliantly self-reinforcing in the sense that, you know, here we are, where we're at this moment where it's possible to make these radical arguments and have a whole bunch of people agree with you. I mean, it isn't 1988 anymore, right? I mean, 1988, that was bad timing because this was a moment of triumphalism for the ideology. When they were winning the argument, they've pretty much lost the argument. I mean, capitalism is a battered brand. People know it isn't working for them, but they don't know what to do about it because this system has so successfully waged war on the public sphere that we don't know how to gather, we don't know how to organize anymore. We have a whole generation that has absolutely no experience with any relationship with public institutions other than their dismantling. So this is a system that has been very, very good at atomizing us. Everything down to the technologies that sort of keep us divorced from nature, and this is the thing about climate change, is that it is place-based. You have to know your natural environment to understand what's playing out before you. And in so many ways, we have a system that keeps us from noticing. California is in the middle of a drought, but I hazard to guess that if you go to the supermarket, it'll be filled with food, right? So just even knowing the extent to which farmers around you are suffering is something that a lot of people don't even feel in the middle of, the third year of a severe drought. That's part of how capitalism does it.
The next question. Is there a level of human interference with the Earth's natural order where everything starts shutting down?
Yeah, I think that's what we're talking about here tonight. But I don't think, I don't think this is about the fact that we humans are going to kill the Earth. I think the Earth is going to survive. It will recover from the damage that we do eventually. It will turn into something else. It will stay alive. We are making it less alive, there's no doubt. I mean, we're in the midst of a mass extinction. But I think there is this way, and I write about this in the book, that there's a way in which the sort of logo of the environmental movement, the Earth from space, has been this sort of core conceptual problem where we imagined ourselves in this godlike position, looking down at this beautiful, fragile blue marble, and cast ourselves in the role of the planet's savior, when really, we need to save ourselves from this planet that has the power to shake us off, screw up too badly.
This common question drew an unexpected answer. As consumers, what is the single most important change we can do?
We can't, as consumers. That's the most important thing. I think as consumers, it's to remember that we're more than consumers, and to organize together in our communities, in our workplaces, in our schools, in our faith organizations, and join movements like the fossil fuel divestment movement, and demand the kind of regulatory changes that we need in order to respond in time. We've lost so much time to changing our light bulbs. We don't have any more time to lose.
And the last question. How long have you been reporting on climate change, and what started your interest in the first place?
The research that I did for The Shock Doctrine is a book that came out 7 years ago, that the last couple years of that research was about climate change, because that book started off as being a book about Iraq and about how the shock of the war was laying the groundwork for this rapid fire privatization and ramming through these very unpopular neoliberal policies. Then I started to look at how economic crises were used in the same way, and then I started to notice that it was happening in the aftermath of natural disasters, so-called natural disasters. So I would say, since Katrina, but this book, this particular project began when I first heard the argument about climate debt. I heard it from Bolivia's trade ambassador, Angelica Navarro, and I wrote a piece about it for Rolling Stone. And I came to it because I was actually doing research on reparations for slavery. I was doing a piece on what had happened to the reparations movement, because it had been very strong for a while before September 11th, and then it kind of disappeared. So I was writing a piece about how that happened and what happened, and I think that debate is alive again in this country, in large part thanks to the incredible work of Ta-Nehisi Coates. But so I was doing that research focused on the UN conference in Durban, South Africa, that happened right on the eve of September 11th, 2001. It ended on September the 9th. And it was a real breakthrough in articulating the fact that we will really never deal with the legacy of institutional racism unless we deal with the economic legacy of colonialism and slavery. And so I was working on this piece, and somebody said, you should talk to Angelica, because she's doing this work about climate that is really related to this. And Angelica laid out the argument for how, if we take climate change seriously and we take our historical responsibility seriously in the global north, it could lead to what she called a Marshall Plan for planet Earth. And suddenly this issue that I had been sort of like avoiding because it was like too big and too scary, and I didn't see anything but sort of apocalypse, I saw how it could be a catalyst for transformation, how it could be the tool to heal our festering wounds, and that's when I decided that I really wanted to immerse myself in this topic. And I think that that's important because, you know, fear is a catalyst. It can be a catalyst, but we need somewhere. You know, it makes us run, it makes us jump, but we need somewhere to run to. It's not just about being afraid. It's that combination of fear and possibility, of fear and hope. And I think that if we, if we allow ourselves to believe that we can build this different world, that we can fight inequality, that we can do what actually needs to be done to address this crisis, then we have that powerful combination. And as I said, I think I really caught glimpses of that in the climate march in New York, in the way in which it mobilized, you know, some of the lowest income communities in the city, in the way that it looked like the city. I've never been to an environmental protest that was not, you know, overwhelmingly white and upper middle class. And this wasn't, this was different. And it felt completely different for that reason. Thank you guys so much.
That was the question and answer period after the talk by Naomi Klein, author of This Changes Everything. She spoke in Santa Rosa, California on October 17, 2014 at the Veterans Auditorium. The Canadian writer Naomi Klein first received worldwide attention with her book, No Logo, that went on to become an international bestseller, and The Shock Doctrine, a critical analysis of the history of neoliberal economics. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. You can get information on how to order a CD at cost of the one-hour program by calling 1-707-463-2654. You can also place an order on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.